Welcome to another UCTV.tv podcast presented by University of California Television.
So I'm delighted to introduce our next speaker, Peter Snyder, who came from Hawaii to join us. He, despite an incredibly busy travel schedule, Peter perennially makes his way here to our conference. Peter's a thought leader in local drug delivery to inhibit restenosis. He's a surgical PI on the impact, the Medtronic impact drug-eluting balloon trial, and he's going to give us an update on what's going on with drug-eluting balloons or drug-eluting stents. Peter Snyder.
Thanks, Chris, and good morning. That was a great summary of what's happening right now with guidelines and with efforts to come together on that. And in a way, it's a nice segue into the next subject, which is really about a new technology that you're going to hear a lot more about in the next couple of years. Here are my conflicts, and as Chris said, I'm involved in a drug-coated balloon trial, which just started enrolling in the United States. And suffice it to say that in Europe, where the regulatory system is quite a bit different and where almost every tool we get, they get 3 to 5 years sooner, there's been a real explosion, if you will, of drug-coated balloon technologies. In fact, if you get a chance to go to any European meeting anytime in the next year, what you'll find is that there's a lot of talk about drug-coated balloons and drug-eluting stents in the non-coronary arteries. And so in the next few minutes, what I'll do is kind of go through some of what we do know so far. It's mostly based on European data, but I think it's going to be a big impact on our practices. And I can just say that what I'm seeing at Kaiser, where I have a captive population in the middle of the ocean, is I'm seeing fewer presentations based on plaque rupture. That is, the coronary acute myocardial infarction is down. Acute carotid syndromes are down. But what's up is lower extremity disease. And these people have harbored lesions, occlusions, whatever it is, for many years. And now they're living longer with drug-eluting stents in the coronaries and statins in the bloodstream. And they're going to step on a fish hook or a sharp shell sooner or later, and they're going to come in with a foot lesion. And we're seeing actually an increase in that, despite the fact that we have all these great ways to manage risk factors. So having said that, let's go back to the drug-eluting balloons and drug-eluting stents. So again, I think that lower extremity is going to be the growing part of our practice for some time, and especially below the knee. But if you're going to create a drug-eluting balloon or a drug-eluting stent, you've got some substantial challenges here in terms of what the drug is and what the dose ought to be and how it ought to be delivered. And in fact, we've seen some failed efforts. And if you look at the incidence of restenosis throughout the body, it's shocking to me that carotid stents don't all restenose, but in fact it has one of the lowest restenosis rates so far of the places where we do interventions. The renals have certainly a restenosis rate that's definitely not negligible, but it's not overwhelming. The iliacs are our favorite, of course, and without the iliacs, a lot of the things that we have done over the years we might not have had the courage to do if not for such good results with iliac stenting. But as soon as you get below the groins, things get depressing very quickly with respect to catheter-based technologies. And we've tried a lot of things over the years without a real substantial improvement, in my opinion. Certainly not a log-scale improvement, maybe some very small incremental improvements. And part of the challenge is that I really don't think the SFA was meant to be scaffolded the way that we're doing it. The only time in the patient's life when the artery is straight is when you're yelling at them to keep still on the angio table. The whole rest of their life, the artery is on the move, which means that the implant is on the move. And the truth is that our so-called minimally invasive treatments cause too much injury. Balloon angioplasty causes too much acute injury. stents cause too much chronic injury, and we really need to find a way to ameliorate that injury if we're going to make progress in this area. So you just heard about the TASC guidelines. And when we treat lower extremity disease, we base it on different things. Well, one of the things besides the clinical factors is a kind of length and severity of disease that helps us to decide what kind of treatment we're going to do. Below the knee, it's a little bit different, though, because these are more likely to be critical limb ischemia patients, probably almost exclusively. And we're looking at things like tissue damage and runoff. Nevertheless, no one would argue that better patency in any of these procedures, whether the patient's a claudicator or a critical limb ischemia patient, would be a bad thing. I mean, I think that in order for endo in the lower extremities to really work, we need a leap forward. And, you know, drug-coated balloons might be it. So let me just show you some of the more recent data. A lot of it's not published because it's coming almost like a wave. Some is published, and there's going to be a lot more within the next year. So we're all familiar with this, the Thunder trial, very high profile, using paclitaxel in the lower extremities, published in the New England Journal, has a decrease in late lumen loss. And, of course, no one sits around the house and says, well, you know what, honey, I got a terrific late lumen loss. I'm feeling so good. But it also has a decrease in angiographic restenosis that's pretty impressive and a decrease rate of repeat revascularization. Well, here's that same trial, not yet published, but has been presented a couple of months ago, the 5-year follow-up, looking at the TLR rates, 44% versus 9% at 5 years, along with some other information. Now, at this point, 5 years later, this is a dwindling number of patients, so you can't draw too many sweeping conclusions. But this is really different than the long-term data that was published with drug-eluting studies before, because we had the sense with drug-eluting studies that the initial benefit is lost over time. And this 5-year follow-up of the Thunder is suggesting that it's not lost over time. This is also presented by Gunnar Tepe at the LINC meeting, and again is the 5-year follow-up in those patients with regards to event probability of coated versus plain balloon. And then the other major trial that was published in Circulation in 2008, already 4 years now, showing similar results. This is the FEMPAC trial, and this is the long-term outcome without reintervention in these patients, coated balloon versus non-coated balloon. Here's another prospective randomized trial. This is the Levant 1 study. The Levant 1 study was done in Europe. The Levant 2 study is enrolled. It's 450 patients. It's in the United States. The Levant 2 study, of course, was sponsored by Lutonix, and Lutonix was just bought within the past 2 months by Bard, which means that Bard being a U.S.-based company and Lutonix being a U.S.-based company, that this is where people are really kind of getting ready for the development of this concept and marketing it and getting it approved for use in the United States. So this is the results. We don't know Levant 2 yet, but with Levant 1, you can see that the lumen, late lumen loss, again, between drug-coated and standard PTA was substantially different. When patients required a bailout stent, they were compared, again, using drug-coated versus plain balloon during bailout stent. It seemed that the benefit was sustained even when the patient required a bailout stent. The pacifier trial, this was presented, again, not yet published, presented at CIRSE, which is primarily an interventional radiological meeting in Europe, but becoming more multidisciplinary all the time. And the pacifier study here is compared now with Thunder, FEMPAC, Levant 1, and these are all four prospective randomized trials, all looking at late lumen loss and comparing standard balloons in the gold versus drug-coated balloons in the blue. And the binary restenosis rate in the pacifier trial at 1 year was 10% versus 31%. All of these things seem to be suggesting that there is a sustained benefit, and now it's been repeated several times over in widely disparate geographic areas using different preparations, all of them with paclitaxel, but different types of excipients and different types of protocols for delivery. Of note is that the provisional stent rate doesn't quite ever go away. In other words, that thing I mentioned about balloon angioplasty causing too much acute injury, that's still going to be an issue because balloons are still balloons, and it still has the same mechanism of action. And so in this pacifier trial, about a third of the control group and about 20% of the drug-eluting balloon group both got stents. And so if you look a little bit more broadly at these four trials, there's actually, without boring you with this, there's some similarity in the late lumen loss. The mean lesion lengths that were treated were in the range of 6 to 8 centimeters. So these were not typically the longer lesions that we deal with on a day-to-day basis in practice. And these are the peripheral and coronary drug-coated balloons that have CE mark. Of course, there is no approved drug-coated balloon for use that we could get our hands on if we felt we really needed one. But I think that eventually that day will come. I do think that the FDA is not just worried about drug device combinations, they're almost allergic to it in the sense that they are in an environment where they are so risk averse that I think it's probably going to take us quite some time to get a drug-coated balloon approved. And so just again, looking at these trials, so the Thunder and FEMPAC trials were both done using PacoCath. That's a MedRad device. Levant 1, the MOXIE balloon, that's Lutonix, now Bard. The IMPACT pacifier trial, that's Medtronic. So you can see there are a lot of players, a lot of people that are interested in this. This is an Italian registry using the IMPACT balloon. And just, this is a little hard to see, but basically showing an 83% primary patency at 12 months with only 12% of patients getting bailout walking and a substantial improvement in quality of life and walking improvement. And of course, as I mentioned, 5-year data now on Thunder, 2-year data on FEMPAC. So those longer term data are going to accumulate. But keep in mind, like every new technology, we're still on the low end of the range in terms of the lesions that have really been tested. And for us to really know how this is going to be used in our clinical practice, we've got to use it on lesions that are more like what we see on a regular basis, which is more task C and D lesions. So just to jump now to drug-eluting stents, we know what happened in the coronaries, and we know that there was an 81% reduction in repeat revascularizations when bare metal stents were excluded and drug-eluting stents came onto the scene and gained most of the market share or most of the cases. But there's a big difference between a drug-eluting stent that you might have in a coronary and a drug-eluting stent in a lower extremity. Obviously, the long, flexible, larger caliber nature of the artery with extrinsic compressive forces is really just completely different than the coronary. So the fact that drug-eluting stents have become the standard of care in the coronaries, and I don't see that changing for the foreseeable future, I'm not at all sure. In fact, probably I would, if I had to bet today, I'd bet against drug-eluting stents becoming the standard of care in the lower extremity, at least to the extent that it is in the coronaries. I don't think it'll be an overwhelmingly used tool the way it is in the coronaries. Nevertheless, somebody might just hit the jackpot, and you can see that whether it's Cook or Cordis or Abbott or Boston or one of these other companies, everybody has a little formula on how they're going to get the drug on there, what's the sticky stuff going to be, and what's the drug going to be, and how much of it is there going to be. And this is the Sirocco trial, which initially showed some benefit, but then there was a substantial catch-up in restenosis rates by 2 years. So that leads us then to the present, where the Zilver PTX now has concluded a trial in the U.S. And there's a lot of excitement around Zilver PTX, and I think that this will be approved. It was, it did have a favorable review from the FDA. CMS has not yet spoken on it, to my knowledge. But basically, it's paclitaxel with no polymer, which is different than coronary stents, of course. And then a dose in the 3 microgram range. And this is the prospective study they set up with 479 patients, PTA versus Zilver PTX. And then for failed PTA, which half the patients did, about half of these had a failed PTA. That is, they needed a bailout stent. When a bailout stent was needed, they were randomized yet again to either a bare Zilver or a Zilver PTX. So it's kind of a double randomization scheme, which leads to a very colorful Kaplan-Meier curve when you look at it 2 years later. And what you see is that there is a signal. At 2 years, the Zilver PTX has a better patency than any of the other formulas. And just to go back to the original randomization, here are the all PTA patients, 241 patients. The reason why the curve starts at 50% is because there was a 50% bailout rate. So if you think back to the Resilient trial, that's exactly how their data was presented. So a 50% bailout rate and then additional fall off after that. And these are a couple of groups. The second best group actually was the group with a successful balloon angioplasty at the time of intervention where no bailout stent was required. And then in the second randomization, that is for those failed PTAs, some got the bare stent, some got the coated stent, and there was a difference at 12 months, almost 90% versus 73%. And of course, it always matters what the lesions were, and these were not super long lesions, normal to normal, 63 millimeters. So you can just say maybe these were 6 centimeter lesions. But there were a substantial number of occlusions, and more than a third of them were considered severely calcified. And then at the same time, I'm not going to go into this, but at the same time, there was a registry that Cook ran. This was outside the U.S., and these really included more of the garden variety lesions that we see on a day-to-day basis, TASC C&D, restenoses, long lesions, and many occlusions. And you can see what the freedom from TLR rate was like at 24 months, not too bad. Although I have to say freedom from TLR is not anywhere near what we would need to make a judgment. The only point here is that they treated real patients with real lesions, the results of which I'm not totally sure. The randomized trial, though, I think is of some use to really help us understand what's going on. So I'm just going to spend one more minute and talk about below the knee. I realize we just mostly talked about above the knee. But if you look at studies that assessed wound healing, so that is patients with critical limb ischemia, these are apparently difficult wounds to heal. This is the percent of wounds that were healed at 6 months, and it was less than 50% in every study that looked at it. This is mean days to complete healing. And this is a substantial period of time, some stretching out to two-thirds or half a year or two-thirds of a year. So in terms of better patency, my sense is that with critical limb ischemia patients, we probably need better patency than we've been getting because it does take longer time frames to heal those wounds. This is a conglomeration put together by Ferrarese. He's one of the real shakers and movers in limb salvage in Italy. Just to point out the fact that almost all the below-the-knee studies that have been done on short lesions. This is 100 millimeters. And then there are these two studies, and again, this is his study, these two studies that are looking at longer lesions. This is also important because we do see long lesions. And this is, I think, of note. And what this is from Leipzig, Germany, Andre Schmidt, published a paper looking at PTA of long lesions, mean lesion length 18.4 centimeters, and then did angiograms at 3 months, and there was a 31% patency. That doesn't surprise me very much. But then he did a study to follow. So this was not randomized. These were successive studies, 109 patients, mean lesion length 17.6 centimeters, almost the same, using drug-coated balloons. Angio the patients at 3 months, they had a 73% patency. So this is, to me, this is what we're looking for. I mean, if I can get a 73% patency, whereas my current technology gives me 31%, again, 3 months is a short time frame, but I think we all get the point that the patency is better. And the other thing is that the pattern of repeat disease was different. Only 10% had a full segment restenosis or occlusion, whereas the typical scenario with non-drug coated balloons is to have an occlusion. And the last trial I'll cite below the knee, this is a prospective study, mean lesion length 12 centimeters. These are CLI patients, 12-month follow-up, comparing drug-eluting balloons with PTA and a substantially lower rate of restenosis and reocclusion. And then lastly, drug-eluting stents below the knee. There have been 3 trials. Only one has been published so far, but I think within the year, all 3 will be published. These are short lesions. I think the longest lesions in these trials were 4 or 5 centimeters. But the key thing is that there is a signal from drug-eluting stents below the knee. And lastly, the cost. Well, all we really can do is point to the coronaries. We have no idea really what these balloons are going to cost in practice, but my sense is that the cost is not going to be the balloon itself. The cost is what we're doing now with reintervention. The big ticket item, in my opinion, is reintervention. In fact, when they looked at drug-eluting stents, in the coronaries, despite the fact that at the index procedure the cost was almost $2,000 more and they had to have years of clopidogrel follow-up, the cost outweighed by reintervention in the non-DES group at 1 year. So it only took 1 year to pay the cost of the additional expense of the technology up front. So in conclusion, extended patency with drug-eluting balloons, I think, is going to be a major contribution. I think given the talk you heard before this, where we're talking about guidelines, how you introduce a new technology and how accepted should it be, what level of evidence do we need? I think we can say the evidence is mounting, not quite there yet, but it's certainly dramatically better than what we knew a year ago. I'm not sure about drug-eluting stents, and my sense is that drug-eluting stents are going to have more challenge than drug-eluting balloons in being accepted, but I do think that there will be situations where we need drug-eluting stents for those very compromised patients with recurrent disease or very long segment disease or heavily calcified disease that's not amenable to balloon technology alone. Thank you very much.
You've been listening to a podcast by University of California Television. For more information about this program or UCTV, visit us online at uctv.tv.